Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Now, Booker Prize winning author John Banville, former Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, and screen and stage actor Clelia Murphy, you're all very welcome.
Thank you very much.
It sounds kind of like a setup for a joke, doesn't it? A Booker Prize winner, an ex-Taoiseach and an actress walk into a bar, but it's not.
What part of the joke?
Who knows where that joke would go? We won't even speculate. Yeah. And we've asked you all for Christmas gift book ideas. Specifically, which books are so special that you'd give them as a gift over and over? So, John, the last time you were in here was summer and we discovered you hate summer. How do you feel about Christmas?
I hate Christmas even more than I hate summer. It just goes on forever. Christmas used to be quite short and quite nice. It was something to look forward to. Now it starts around the middle of July and goes on till March. So I hate it.
Fair enough. Clelia, I bet you love Christmas.
Well, I loved it up to there. Yeah. Like, I do. I love it. But I have to be honest with you now. I can't stop thinking of Tommy Tiernan now and his wife on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, that could become a national tradition.
That's a new image. That's what my husband said in the car as I was on my over. He said, well, that's what we're all going to be thinking about the night the baby Jesus was born.
And look, it would ensure that every married couple did it at least once a year.
Well, it's going to be a marker in our calendar now, yeah.
Yeah, good. Leo, are you looking forward to Christmas?
Yeah. I love Christmas. I agree with John that it goes on too long, so I refuse to engage in it until about the first weekend in December. But after that, I'm totally on board.
And your life is more your own these days.
It is, yeah. So usually I would have been, like as a doctor before, I would have worked over Christmas. Mm. And then as a politician, would have been hell for leather up until the recess and then try and get everything done by the 23rd or 24th December and get out of there. And then you'd come back for the trolleys around the 2nd of January because they're unfortunately are almost an annual occurrence. But different this year. But one thing, I just love the... Love going out, love the parties, love the Christmas tree, love the decorations. And one thing I really like is that period just after Christmas, from Stephen's Day onwards, when friends are back from home or friends are back from abroad, they're sick of their families and everyone gets to catch up, and that's really nice.
And people get together with their chosen family, family of origin, yes. Mm. Okay, so between the three of you, you've picked a mix of fiction, biographies, poetry, books for kids, but we start with some non-fiction. So Leo, your first choice feels a bit close to home for you. It's Gavin Riley's The Secret Life of Leinster House.
Yeah, I hope it's not too predictable, but it's a nice book. I think it'd be a really good stocking filler for anyone who is interested in politics or news. And it's just a bit of a kind of guide to how politics works in Ireland, what whips do, what special advisors do, election campaigns, parliamentary procedures, that kind of stuff. A quick read, a nice book you could read on a plane. Or
did you learn anything new from it?
I didn't usually because I was in the business. No is a short and honest answer to that. But I think there are a lot of people who, knock on doors, who canvass, who drop leaflets, who are interested in politics, but wouldn't actually know some of these kind of behind the scenes mechanics.
My stepson, so like Finn, would love that. He's into that.
And since you're out of that Leinster House scene now, do you realise now it's a bit of a bubble?
I always knew it was a bubble.
Yeah.
That's why I didn't get trapped in it.
Yeah.
I know even more so that that's true because I just don't follow it the way I would have before. Like I follow the news and I'm interested in what's going on in the world. But what happened at Leaders' Questions, I wouldn't have a notion.
Okay, it's grand for you now. John, you've gone for a biography of someone. She actually would have turned 100 in June. It's Marilyn Monroe by Donald Spotto.
Yes, I haven't read this book before, even though Marilyn has always been one of my heroes.
Why?
I think she's just a wonderful creature. She's one of the great... People get it wrong when I say this, but she's one of the great clowns. The creature that she invented, Marilyn Monroe, is one of the most memorable figures of our time. There's a wonderful story. She's walking along Fifth Avenue with a friend of hers, and they're talking about Marilyn Monroe. And she's wearing a headscarf and dark glasses and a raincoat. And she says, you want me to be her? Takes off the glasses, the headscarf, puts the thing, does the walk. Within 10 seconds, there are 20 people around asking for an autograph. And the other nice story, she's sitting in front of a mirror somewhere, just staring into the mirror, and somebody says to her, what are you doing, Marilyn? He said, I'm looking at her. So there were always two people there.
Yeah.
But Spoda's biography is very, very good. It shows what a sweet-natured person she was. She was a very sweet woman. She knew what she was doing. She was always in control. She was a very fine artist. And she was horribly treated by the men around her. And I'm going to write a stage play on her last days or her last weeks.
Are you?
Yeah.
So for you, she's one of the great figures of the 20th century, clearly.
Yes.
And so it was a kind of, the whole thing was a Warholian kind of performance art, a creation of a pop culture icon, basically, by this woman, Norma Jean.
Norma Jean Baker, she created Marilyn out of need because she didn't know her origins and she was very insecure in the world. But when she'd created this thing, she saw what it was and she saw its potential. And she saw its potential, especially in America, the latter half of the 20th century, or the middle part of the 20th century. And the things she could get away with. I mean, she was the one person that could waggle her bum and not have people condemning her for it.
Yeah. Then I'm reminded of the Elvis books by Peter Goralnik. Have you ever read them? How becoming an icon becomes a prison in itself as well, in a way. Clelia. Mm. So that's Marilyn Monroe by Donald Spotto. And we put all these up on the website. You have a memoir for us next.
I do.
A Mind of My Own by Kathy Burke. Just remind people who Kathy Burke is.
She's an incredibly versatile. She's an actor. She's a writer. She's a director. Everybody will know her. She's more famous for her comedy work. She was with Harry Enfield and Chums. She played Wayne and Wayne, a slob.
Yeah.
She would have been in Gimme, Gimme, Gimme. That comedy with Tom, outrageous couple, the odd couple living in an apartment together. But she was also, she won Best Actress, she won a Palme d'Or Best Actress for a film that she made with Gary Oldman, Nailed by Mouth. So it's an incredible life that she's had, completely opposite to Marilyn Monroe in that one of her first memories is being called ugly. And I've audiobooked this as well, by the way. So this is. I was coming from the point of view that if you were looking for an unusual present to give somebody, I love consuming a book through an audiobook. So this is why I'm listening to this book at the moment. And she had a very tough upbringing. Her mother died when she was 18 months old. So she's always had a sense of being famous. She's been famous as the kid whose mother was dead. And she's a testament to herself. And she reads the book herself. So it's an extraordinary listen to. And all the heartbreak and the turmoil, and she's had a tough life, but she's brought joy and humour to all these things that have happened to her in her life. Like, it's a wonderful listen to.
Yeah.
And her voice is so singular. She has that kind of raspy kind of northern or East End London voice. But she's Irish. Her father was Irish and her mother was Irish.
It does have echoes kind of polarity, of Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
The kind of, so you create this edifice to put out there for the world.
She was big into punk rock. She understood that scene. She's a smart, again, wasn't particularly academic, but was a really smart, smart lady. Wrote her first play at 22. Things that you think you know about people. And then you listen to her book. And like, she goes into things, but not too deeply. She talks about a love, but she doesn't get into it. It's worth a listen.
Okay, A Mind of My Own by Kathy Burke. And you're suggesting audiobook for that.
Yeah.
Okay, let's turn to classic fiction now. Leo, why have you picked The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood as a gift?
One of my favorite books. Loved the miniseries as well, which I think a lot of people would have seen. There's also a sequel, Testaments, and I think she's like a memoir out or some sort of memoir out at the moment.
She does,
there's a lot of Margaret Atwood options at the moment if you're interested. I think what appeals to me about it, apart from it being scary and interesting and dystopian and a really great story, is the extent to which I fear it's prophetic.
Yeah.
This book was written in 1985. By Margaret Atwood is all about how an America of the future might turn to the hard right, gets taken over by effectively a male Christian group of commanders, of leaders, and seeks to turn America into Gilead, which is a white Christian nationalist state in which women are reassigned to their traditional roles, either as birth giver or carer, where LGBT people are unpersoned and end up dead on the wall, where there's no free speech, where you know, universities, NGOs, the media are undermined and brought under control. And it tells the whole story of that, and also the kind of paranoia around environmental destruction, nativism, not enough babies are being born, therefore we must take freedom away from women and force women sometimes to have babies. It is really quite scary, but it's not far off some of the things we're starting to see happen around the world, are some of the kind of thinking that is starting to become mainstream in the world.
I like it. It became a big thing around Trump 1, but I always felt the parallels, I couldn't see them exactly. But Trump 2, actually, it was the Charlie Kirk Stadium gig that time, which turned into this religious rally. And they all talked about a religious revival, and they all talked about the need to have more children and everything. I suddenly looked at that and thought, this time it's Gilead.
If you look at the, don't need to get too political, but if you look at the national security statement that was put out there last week, one thing it refers to, and it's a really strong line, is that nothing that they want to achieve can be achieved without more traditional families having more strong babies.
Yeah,
Which is, you
and
know,
they're getting that message.
I'm not against traditional families having babies, but you know, once you start to try and impose that as a policy on people, you're then into a world, you know, and we, when we see it around the world, we see Islamic states, you know, we see Hindu nationalism in India, where again, people are being told not to be free, not to live by democratic principles, but to live by religious principles. And it's not just America, the rise of religion in taking over politics is happening in Brazil, there's a bit of it in India too. Russia, Putin has adopted Orthodox Christianity for very cynical reasons.
There's a lot of that going on.
Israel, the Jewish state, you've Iran, the Islamic Republic, all these things are different.
And a lot of celebs kind of taking on that.
Totally different.
Yeah. Okay, The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood, new again.
Trump 2 is bad. Where did we get Vance 1?
Yeah. Vance, who would remind you of one of the characters from the TV series of The Handmaid's Tale, I always think. He has that look of one of the captains. Clelia, your classic fiction is Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Yeah, Wuthering Heights. So I myself and Leo, we did this on our Leaving Cert, which was about discovered. So we are 4 years apart.
We're about King Lear then as well.
Yeah, King Lear. Oh, I love it a bit. Yeah. So for me, this was a great way of learning about literature. It was a good gateway book into learning about, you know, the pathetic fallacy, the gothic novel, the, you know. So it's, so for anybody who hasn't read it yet, do, because the film, another film is coming out. It's an intense gothic novel about the destructive love between the wild Catherine Earnshaw and the brooding Heathcliff, and the fact how their love destroys generations around them. And it's set in the wilds of Yorkshire in this house called Wuthering Heights.
And I think it does appeal to teenagers, the intensity it's
Twilight without the vampires. It's nothing new. Like, every generation thinks that they're after discovering, oh, this is the first, oh, my first impression of love. It's not. Wuthering Heights came first, guys.
Did you have your Heathcliff when you were a romantic
teenager?
We all
had our Heathcliff. Yeah. And then you realise, oh God, he's not dark and brooding and silent. He's just as shallow as a puddle on a sunny day, but he's good looking. Do you know what I mean? So there's a new film. There's another film coming out with, I have it written down because I have to remember everything. Jacob B. Lordy. Is that right? How you pronounce his name? And Margot Robbie are playing Heathcliff. And it's coming with this controversy. People are already talking about, oh, this is not how we imagine these characters to be. And Emerald Fennell of Saltburn fame is the director.
Okay. So you're saying go back to the text.
Go back to the text and then you can be part of the conversation. Yeah.
Okay. Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte. Mm-hmm. John Banville, you've chosen Venice, City of Pictures by Martin Gayford. Your latest novel is set in Venice. Do you love Venice?
I have a very ambiguous relationship with Venice. I love parts of it, and I find parts of it absolutely disgusting. I always tell the story that I was walking through one of those little alleys with somebody one winter twilight. An enormous rat ran across in front of us and wedged itself in a crevice, but it left its tail out, and we both said, Venice. But, of course, it is an exquisitely beautiful city. And this book by Martin Gayford, Venice, City of Pictures, is one of the best things you can read on, because he is an art critic he's not an academic. His enthusiasm is evident on every page. He lets us wear his learning very lightly. It's a splendid book, splendidly entertaining, and it goes right from the beginning in the 1300s up to the present day. And it's also a marvellous guide, incidentally, a marvellous guide to Venice.
Yeah. I went there for the first time, early this year, I think. And the thing is, you get there and you go, okay, it does exist. Because, like, we've seen it so much, but yet there's nothing can compare with seeing it there hovering on the water. But then one of the things as well, it's an incredible feat. You're reminded all the time what an incredible feat it was to build this, the centre of an empire there in a lagoon.
Yes, and they were extraordinary people, the Venetians. In the 1400s, they were producing a ship a day, a fully fitted ship, one a day.
Okay.
Can you imagine the ingenuity?
Certainly,
we can't.
In Ireland 2025, we can't imagine that. They must have had a very good department for infrastructure and shipbuilding. Okay, that's Venice City of Pictures by Martin Gayford. Let's do a couple of children's books next. Leo, you've chosen an old one, but a classic, The Happy Prince by Oscar Wilde, and you have a beautiful old...
I have a first edition.
Have you?
Beautiful gift given to me by a friend of mine, Jan. It's actually The Young King and Other Stories, but one of the stories in it is The Happy Prince. It's only about 7 pages long. It's a beautiful story. It's a children's story, but also it's a story for adults as well, because there's a lot of strong themes and a lot of strong messages in it. I think one thing actually, if you have to have the budget to do it, but a really nice gift to give somebody if you are going to give them a book, is an antiquarian book. A first edition or an old edition. It's something kind of special. It's like vintage wine. There's something special about the look of it, the feel of it, all of those things. But this is a story of a prince. After he dies, he's turned into a statue made of gold and rubies, sapphire eyes. And only when he's up on his pedestal can he see the world fully. And he looks down on the city and he sees poverty, he sees pain, he sees suffering, he sees injustice. And he asks the swallow bit by bit to take him apart, to give away his sapphire eyes, to give away the ruby from his sword, to give away the gold flakes that cover him, to the poor of the city. And each time the swallow is delaying his journey, he's supposed to migrate to Egypt for the winter. And it ends with the swallow dying at the feet of the happy prince, because it's too late for him to fly south, and the town council deciding to melt down the statue because it looks so shabby. And if things aren't beautiful, they're not useful anymore. And then they have an argument over whether they're going to have a statue of themselves or somebody else. But it ends very beautifully. It ends with God sending one of his angels down to the city to find the two most beautiful things. And it's the lead heart of the prince and the body of the swallow. And there's a lot of themes there, a lot of stories. It's not at the end everyone doesn't learn a lesson and they don't change their ways. It's not one of those kind of preachy things. But it shows, I think, in many ways that kindness can be about trying to relieve suffering. You don't always have to change the system. Sometimes you can just be a good person by selflessness, by giving things away, trying to
small
leave suffering.
Acts,
and it's a lovely book.
I read it 1888
or something, and it's still so relevant today.
And it's actually intensely moving. And you were moved there when you were talking.
I don't get teary up, but it is one of the ones that I would for.
Okay,
it is special.
Okay, great choice.
And again, for kids and adults.
That's stunning.
A fantastic choice, The Happy Prince by Oscar Wilde. Clelly, another book for kids. Tell me about Letters from the North Pole by Annie Atkins.
This is beautiful. So Annie Atkins is... She's a renowned graphic designer for film. This is her first book. So you'd know Annie's works if you were a fan of Wes Anderson. So she did all the graphic stuff for the Grand Budapest Hotel.
Okay, yeah.
And the Isle of Dogs. So this, I had to bring in it as well. So it's Letters from the North Pole. And it's a book, and it's really important. Today's the 12th. It's a 12 day, the 12 days of Christmas. And this story starts on the 12th day, the first day of the 12 days of Christmas. And they're all little letters that Santi received from kids around the world with their ideas of what they'd love Santi to make for him for Christmas. And then Santi sends back a letter to the child where you can open it up. So it's a great one to sit.
Oh, yeah, lovely.
So it's gorgeous. And he sends each child back a little. This is your idea and this is what we thought of it. So on the card, you can see one of the cards is she wanted to, Maggie wanted to make a talking parrot. And that was her suggestion. So he comes back and he sends her a little poem back. So it's a great one to sit and read with the kids all over the Christmas. And if you check out Aunt Annie on Instagram, she does interactive workshops where you can make your own letter to Santi and have an accompaniment.
Fantastic. Letters from the North Pole by Annie Atkins.
By Annie
Looks gorgeous.
I have it out as a decoration at home. I bought myself a copy.
It's beautifully,
as well.
Yeah, it's beautifully.
And I gave it to all the kids. And it's one of those books that you will keep forever. And they're the important memories to make for Christmas. Because that's what Christmas is all about.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that brings about, it's evocative, you know.
John, on another note entirely, why would you gift A Life in Letters by John Updike? One of the great dead white males that we all grew up reading, but I think we're not supposed to read anymore now.
I wonder if people read Updike anymore. I mean, all those great literary lions of the last years of the 20th century, they all seem to be forgotten now, certainly not read. They will come back, I think. Updike, I love Updike, not for what he writes, but for the way he writes.
And just to remind people, the ones people would know most are probably the
Couples,
Rabbit Books.
Couples was his greatest success.
Yeah,
I think it's a very fine novel. His concern always was middle class, love affairs, adultery, and the ordinary lives of middle class people on the East Coast of America. I feel that he limited himself somewhat, but when he tried to leave that, as when he wrote about the coup and that novel, that just didn't work at all. That was his area, the East Coast of America, and he was superb, but he wrote like an angel. I mean, his
and the letters then, a lot of the time you read letters by an author you really admire and they turn out to be really quotidian, also petty, often bitter. Is it like that?
No, there's only one or two instances in this very long book when he is bitter and petty, as we all are. but only one or two. And that's, you know, it's a very big book.
Yeah.
And he had, in his life, he did a lot of philandering, but he had some things to be bitter and petty about. But as literary documents, I think they're wonderful. And this book might bring him back and bring his work back into popularity.
Yeah. Are there letters to the various ladies in there? I don't want to be cheap about it, but people
would
enjoy a bit of that.
There are quite a few letters.
Okay.
Love letters.
Yeah, you see, you were burying the lead there.
His love letters are curiously prosaic and they're not detailed.
Okay.
I mean, his books are highly explicit sexually, but the letters are not.
Okay, so that's A Life in Letters, John Updike. Leo, this sounds interesting. Prisoners of Geography, 10 Maps That Explain Everything About the World by Tim Marshall.
Yeah, so this is a great one, and it's been reissued and updated, so it's been updated for the times. I stumbled across it. I was staying in a place in Greece, and you know those hotels where you can leave a load of books behind. And I just kind of found it there, and it felt like something
deadly.
I could,
I love that.
You know, it's kind of you can read by the pool, and it tries to explain the world in 10 maps, which is actually kind of oversimplistic, but it's still very
interesting.
Yes, so Russia, for example, Russia. Everyone knows where Russia is. Moscow. What you have to the west of Moscow and to the west of Russia is a really big open plain. They're not protected by mountains, really, or by any particular geographical features. And it talks about how over the centuries, Russia has faced a number of major invasions from the west. So Napoleon, Hitler, King Charles of Sweden, all came across those plains fast, literally to the borders of the boundary of Moscow, to the boundary of St. Petersburg. And that helps to explain part of their way of thinking and part of their fear and their paranoia of attack, and why they can't surround themselves by mountains to protect them. So they try to surround themselves by buffer states. And that's, for example, why they want to have Belarus, Ukraine, places like that, the Baltic states within their orbit. So, so you know, and I'm very pro-Ukraine. I'm not sympathetic to Russia at all, but it's important to understand people's mindset.
Yeah. And this is core in their psyche, generations of paranoia.
And there's 10 chapters and it all touches on those themes. Now, it is overly simplistic, but it's still an interesting read.
Yeah, it sounds like a great, great primer for things. Okay, Prisoners of Geography, 10 Maps That Explain Everything About the World by Tim Marshall. Couple of poetry books. Clelia, you've picked Lessons in Kindness by a West of Ireland-based poet, Danny Gill.
Danny Gill. So Danny Gill is a curator, she's a writer, she's a producer, and she's an educator. She's an incredible human being. So I just recently did a play that Danny produced, Ferocity, down in Galway, or over in Galway, I should say, for Decadent Theatre. And as actors, we have a little kind of tradition. On the opening night, we give each other a little card and a little present. So this is a gift that I received, and it's a book I'm going to give Clarabel Murphy for Christmas. It's a meditation collection, a collection of the people who make us and the kindnesses that they leave behind. And it's very much a intergenerational book. It's about, like, she's dedicated to her grandmother, and I came from a very matriarchal family like that, so it kind of stood out. And her poems are short and to the point, and you're immediately there with her. And they're
okay. Do you have a good one?
I do. I have a good one. Yeah, very quick, and it's called On Stage. Up there, they will love you, but not for who you are under the lights. When you step off, who are you then? Who loves you? In the wings, in the shadow of yourself, who?
Oh, devastating.
No, I think that's not just about actors. That's about all of us. It's all about identity.
No, totally.
You know, who we are, where we are, where we came from, and who we're going to become. So, and again, it's all in the mindfulness of being a gift. This is a lovely stocking filler. It's a beautiful book as well. You get it from Salmon Poetry. So Danny Gill, an absolute legend of a
book. Okay, Lessons in Kindness.
Gorgeous book.
John, you've gone for 50 Poems by Rainer Maria Rilke.
Yes, it's a little book that's just come out from the publishing side of the New York Review of Books, translated by the Australian poet Geoffrey Lehman. As they say about football, Rilke had a life of poetry of two halves. The first half was what he called his thing poems. Later on, he became much more rhapsodic. And these are just ways of looking at the world, at objects, and describing them as accurately as he could. He spent some time with he was rather effete. He was born in Czechoslovakia, wrote in German, rather effete young man, went to see the sculptor Rodin in Paris, and Rodin said to him, look, go to the zoo, pick an animal, and just study it for about 3 days, and then write a poem about it, which is what he did. And he wrote quite a few poems, but then he learned to look at the world rather than looking at himself. So many poets make the mistake of thinking that their way of looking at the world is what is of interest. It's not. It's what they see and what they can describe. That's what's interesting. And this book is a perfect example of that.
Okay. That's 50 Poems by Rainer Maria Rilke. Leo, there's text here about The Little Prince. I'm a Montessori teacher and I read an illustrated version of The Happy Prince to my children every year. I always cry at the end, and so do they. RTE released as a CD over 25 years ago of the stories of Oscar Wilde, and Alan Stamford read The Happy Prince, as this texter. It's a childhood memory for our children, played in the car on a long journey. They loved it. That's from Emer and Sword. So I'd say you might have started a little tradition in a lot of families there with that one. Okay, final choices now. Leo, you've gone for Colin McCann's A Paragon, which came out a few years ago, but probably more relevant than ever now.
Yeah, I'm actually reading it now, so nearly finished. It's one of those books that I wanted to read if I could ever get around to reading it. And
Is there a lot of those at the end of a career?
It's a good few. And you got a lot of gifts.
Of catching
books.
Up to do.
You got a lot of gifts of books.
There's always
you never
a lot of books
them.
On the side of your table.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you look at them going and they haunt you.
But I'm finally getting through them one by one, and this is one of these really beautiful books. It tells the story of Rami and Bassam, a Palestinian and an Israeli. Both their daughters were killed, one by a soldier, the other in a bomb. And they learn to become friends. That's actually a true story, or it's mainly a true story. And they travel the world and become advocates for peace. But what I really love about it is actually the way it's written. This really is a literary masterpiece, in my view. It's one of the ones that you probably shouldn't read on a plane. You should actually, you know, have some quiet time at home, sit down on the couch, make sure you have an hour or two to get through it properly. It's divided into 1,001 small parts, small chapters, and that recalls Scheherazade and the thousand, you know, the what's it called?
The Thousand One Nights.
You know, which fits into the region, obviously. And it has a huge amount of imagery and metaphors, a lot of things around bird flight and bird song. It's not strictly linear as well, so it's not exactly in chronological order. It's one of those books you have to concentrate on. Have one glass of wine, not two. But it really, really is a beautiful book, and I'm absolutely loving it, and I'd really recommend it.
Okay, and some kind of an antidote to an endless cycle of hatred and violence.
Yeah, well, look, it doesn't have a happy ending, obviously, and this was written 10 years ago, but it does speak about really important human themes. You know, around forgiveness, around people who can really suffer loss, suffer grief, and can forgive and can reach out to the hand to the other side. And it also is about complexity. Often things are so simplified and they're made into black and white and good and bad. And a paragon is actually, I didn't know this, but a paragon is a shape. It's a polygon with an infinite number of sides.
Okay.
And it does tell the story of how anything can have a million different sides, and those sides are individual personal experience.
Good to get off the day-to-day news cycle and read something
political book. It's much more about the story of the two men and their families.
Okay, that's Colin McCann's A Paragon. John, your last book is about the American conservative William F. Buckley. He died in 2008, but he, I think, had anointed Sam Tannenhouse to write his authorised biography before he died.
He did, which was rather surprising because Tannenhouse is very much a liberal former editor of the New York Times Book Review. He does a wonderful job, and this is beautifully written. And incidentally, the book was beautifully produced, which is not often the case nowadays. If you want to understand what's happened to America now, read this, because it all started with Buckley and his people. I mean, the revolution that's happening in America is 100 years old. And Buckley was very much part of that, the conservative revolution. Mm. And a lot of it is still, a lot of what Trump and his people are doing is still a reaction against the 1960s. And Buckley was very much against the 1960s. But it's also, it's a wonderful read.
Yeah.
So I recommend.
So none of this is new? None of this is new, what's happening now. This has been a strain in America for years. Yeah.
He was a wonderfully entertaining person. He had all kinds of friends on the left as well as on the right. He was the opposite of Trump and his gang of thugs. He was a genuinely charming man. But by God, he was a conservative and he would have backed Trump to the hilt.
Right.
Whatever Trump did.
It's called Buckley, The Life and the Revolution That Changed America. If people are wondering who he is, people will have seen footage of him debating people like Gore Vidal and stuff like that. It turns up on those
old shows. Yeah, he had a famous television program, Firing Line, in which he used to get into fights with people. Wonderfully entertaining television.
Yeah, good idea for a show. Yeah.
Yeah.
Clelia, your final book is a book written for children by the late Moncon McGann. It's called Wolfmen and Waterhounds, The Myths, Monsters and Magic of Ireland, and it's illustrated by Steve Dugan.
It's a stunning book. This is it's aimed at children, but it's a book that you'd love to have on your coffee table as well. One of the first books I ever read was The Song of the Children of Lear. And it just ignited my imagination. So I was looking for something for my niece. And it's written in English, but the way he's broken it down is, he puts it himself in the introduction. Our ancestors regarded many parts of Ireland as being gateways to mystical lands or magical other worlds where goddesses, fairies, monsters and other divine beings lived. This book aims to be a guidebook of sorts to some of these portals and thresholds and to the beasts and spirits who guard them. And he breaks it down by the counties and by the places and the monsters that are and the fairies and the myths and legends per place. It's a beautiful book. It's stunning. And I just thought of a bit of a nod to a man who has passed on his passion through his stories and his book for Christmas.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, it kind of feels like his impact is going to go on and on.
If we all had an ounce of his passion, wouldn't it be wonderful?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's Wolfmen and Waterhounds, The Myths, Monsters and Magic of Ireland, illustrated by Steve Dugan. Guys, thank you all so much for that. That completely exceeded expectations.
That was much more than a book slot.
And it shows that with books, the whole world and all human life is in there. When people talk about books,
that's the only thing that differentiates us is the book that you've read or the book that I haven't read. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
That's life.
Okay, fantastic, and great ideas there as well. So thank you very much to our Christmas books panel, writer John Banville, former Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, and actor Clelia Murphy. I nearly said actress.
You can say what you like, yeah. I'll answer to most
actress
things.
Slash actor.
As long as it's not abusive, I'll answer.
Clelia Murphy, thank you all very much. Consider yourselves booked for next year.
Thank you so much.
Email brendan@rte.ie.